entertainment, sports, and radio's best guest list. Live from the Zone Radio Studios on Broadway on WZON Z62, WKIT HD3, and at downtownwithrichkimble.com. This is Downtown.
Well, hello and welcome into a special edition of Downtown. Downtown brought to you every day by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Rich Kimble here, along with Kerry Haskell. And in this special Downtown, we salute one of our favorite guests on the show, documentary filmmaker Ken Burns. In his more than three decades of creating an indelible history of America, Burns has found a way to tell the story of some of the biggest events in American history, but doing it through the eyes of, more often than not of the leaders and not of the big names, but of the average people who really tell the tale of American history. Ken has been with us a number of times on the show, and during this special hour, we'll look back at some of our favorite conversations with Ken Burns. Well, it's safe to say that the series that established Ken as America's documentarian was his epic series on the Civil War. It became, at the time, the most watched series in the history of public television, and Ken visited with us to talk about the 25th anniversary of that landmark series. 25 years later, here we are as a nation still processing the Civil War. Are you mystified by the fact that there are still people out there that denied that the Civil War was about anything other than slavery?
Yeah, but I kind of understand it when it is about something that would seemingly be so abhorrent to Americans, that is to say, the owning of other citizens, 4 million of them in 1861, by the way, 4 million American citizens were owned by other American citizens. You can understand why people might want to drape it in other sort of secondary or tertiary causes like states' rights or nullification or cultural, political, and economic differences, but they all come back in the end to slavery. And, you know, if you look at South Carolina's Articles of Convention, Articles of Secession, it doesn't say, you know, nullification, it doesn't say states' rights. What it says is slavery over and over again.
The incident in South Carolina earlier this year raised the issue of the Confederate flag. Once again, there were certainly soldiers on the Confederate side, on the wrong side of history, who demonstrated heroism and bravery. What's the proper way to honor that?
Well, I think just by making documentary films, for one thing, and we certainly did that and or tried to do that. We certainly were not misled by the cause that they were supporting, which was the wrong one, as Lincoln said at his second inaugural. But we certainly wanted to say, who were these people? And some of them weren't slave owners, and why did they fight, and what was going on? And the battle flag, by the way, the Confederate flag controversy, is a complete red herring. That flag, the Dixie flag, is one of a handful of battle flags of the Army of Northern Virginia. It wasn't the official flag of the Confederacy. That's the stars and bars. That's what flew over Fort Sumter when that fell in April of 1861. That Dixie flag came into prominence after 1954, working its way into the state flags in many of the states of the old Confederacy. And what happened in 1954? The Supreme Court ruled in Brown versus Board of Education that separate but equal was unconstitutional, that desegregation had to take place. And so the use of the Dixie flag in our popular culture is not some heritage thing. It's about resistance to civil rights, which means that you don't believe what Americans believe, which is that all men are created equal, that we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
You're working on a documentary on Jackie Robinson, and you've said that the Civil War documentary and the story of the war continues to inform so much of your work. Is race and how we've dealt with it the defining issue of American history?
Yeah, I think the nature of freedom is probably, Rich, the number one thing. What does freedom mean? Is it individual freedom? Is it collective freedom? What is the tension between those two interpretations? You know, how much does a strong federal government have? How much goes to the states? All of those are the central questions. But the single most important issue is the issue of race. And I don't go looking for it, I promise. It's there. It's not in every film that I've done, but it's there in most of them, and in important ways, and no more important, obviously, than in the Civil War. And it resonates. It's still there. The Civil War is the most important, the defining event in our history. Shelby Foote said in our film. And therefore, when we study it, its resonances, its echoes are all around us all the time, and certainly true in many of the other films that I've done. And more importantly, as your previous question suggests, true in today's front page of a newspaper when you read about this African-American being killed, or you read about the Confederate flag controversy, or you talk about a birther movement against the President of the United States, or you know, all of these things that go back essentially to divisions between people, between Americans, based on the color of their skin and not, as Dr. King said, on the content of their character.
We're talking with Ken Burns here on Downtown. Back when Barack Obama was elected president, there was much self-congratulation, patting ourselves on the back as a nation, and talking about a post-racial era. Does everything that the president has had to endure in the last 7 years or so tell us that that's not really the case?
That was not the case, and if you'd asked me then, I would have told you this is a remarkable, wonderful moment in American history, as I think most Americans, fair-minded Americans would say this is great, regardless if you didn't vote for him or if you did. It was just a wonderful thing to escape the specific gravity of that terrible history. But I don't think you can think things, you wave a magic wand and that's going to end. In fact, of course, as we know, his election bred a kind of metastasized some very, very horrible behaviors on the part of people. You know, The Onion magazine, the satirical magazine, The Onion, when Barack Obama was inaugurated the first time, said, "Black man given worst job in world." And in some ways, as much as you just sort of giggle at that, it was really, really prescient. And a lot of what he's had to work through has nothing to do with his policies. It's had to do with the color of his skin. And that just tells us that as much as we've made extraordinary progress, there's a lot of work still to be done.
The remastered Civil War series airs over 5 nights on PBS starting September 7th. And for those of us here in Maine, extra pride in that Civil War series, because
Indeed.
It really introduced Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain to a nation that didn't know much about him. And how important a figure was Chamberlain to the success of the Union?
For me, he's the bee's knees. He's the guy, he's the reason why I made the series. I read the novel, The Killer Angels. Finished it on Christmas Day 1984, looked up at my dad and said, my next film is going to be on the Civil War. I'd been thinking about it, but this sealed it. The fact that you could have this citizen soldier, not just the great Lincolns, but the people who labor sort of in between, who are so heroic, who do such amazing things, who teach us such valiant things. I just had to do it. And then, of course, we followed the fortunes of Deer Isle, the town of Deer Isle, representing our northern town. So that's very, very important.
On Thursday, Doris Kearns Goodwin, who's contributed to a number of your documentaries, will be on with us. We try to get her on a regular basis, and she's done a wonderful job documenting some of the great figures in American history. You and your films talk about those great figures, but also find terrific stories in the common man, the people whose names have not been celebrated through the years. Is that exciting for you when you begin new adventures to discover those people?
That's the whole joy of what I do, Rich. You've hit it right, the nail right on the head. I mean, obviously, you're going to learn more details. I'm working on a big series on the history of the Vietnam War. You're going to understand about the motivations of President Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon. But the real joy is getting to know the so-called ordinary people, and particularly in times of war or great stress, as in Jackie Robinson's experiment, you begin to realize there's no such thing as ordinary people. And that's the great gift. You find out the person that you just passed on the street, the person who just passed you just now in the car as you're listening, they live a life as full and as rich as yours, and quite often they've got important stories to tell, and that's the great joy of anything, particularly in the Civil War, was to learn the bottom-up as well as top-down story.
I would ask about the Civil War series being exposed to a new generation, but that's not really the case because it's never gone away.
Yes, it's never gone away. I was in an interview the other day, and somebody was sort of saying, well, nearly 39 people watched it 25 years ago, and it was as if it had never been shown again. And of course, it's been in your constant rotation. The good news, and I think will hopefully attract other folks who may not have gotten it in school. It's shown hundreds of times a day, parts of it every day in school, every day in America. And that's very heartening to me and to anyone who believes in the mission of public television. But what we've done in this restoration is we've taken stuff, you know, 16-millimeter thumbnail things and turned them into, you know, beautiful 4K Ultra HD images that will give you new detail, more resolution, less grain, clearer images, better colors, image stabilization. I wept when I went into the studio months ago and saw just the introduction to the series remastered. And I'm very, very excited and happy to be sharing it with you.
Well, and I saw you talk about this on Face the Nation the other day. The fact that your films prove that, yes, we're a nation that sometimes has a short attention span, but when there is a compelling story, people will dive into it headlong.
Yes, that's right. I think all of us, all real meaning accrues in duration. The work that you're proudest of, the work that I'm proudest of, has benefited from our sustained attention. And that's true of anything. Certainly we know what it's like to be flipping through our phones and texting very quickly or looking at something briefly on YouTube, and there's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. But we also know that our human heart yearns for real meaning, and that takes place in duration. And that means sometimes you're going to have to listen to, watch, an 11.5-hour series on the Civil War, or look at, you know, Orange is the New Black, or House of Cards, or Downton Abbey. And that's just a tribute to the human spirit and human imagination that we want to be fed. You know, it's all right to stick your hand in that bag of potato chips. It tastes delicious. But we also need healthier and heartier meals.
Ken Burns on his Civil War series here on a special salute to Ken on Downtown. When we come back, we talk about Jackie Robinson, his impact not only on baseball, but on America.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's 3 times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
Biking season is here, and the only way to be sure that you're road or trail ready is to bring your bike to Slipping Gears Cycling, Bangor's only full-time cycling sales and service experts at 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor before prime riding season slips away. Slipping Gears Cycling, 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor, Bangor's best full-service bike shop. Outstanding service, huge stock. Like them on Facebook for updates, shop in person, and online at slippinggears.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
So you got a little problem and you don't know what to do. Your pipes are getting rusty and the water's leaking through. You know you need a plumber, but you haven't got the dough. Well, listen and I'll tell you about a fella you should know. Just call Tim's Plumbing, they'll be there in a flash. They do great work for not a lot of cash. They'll fix that sink, they'll snake that drain. So the glug, glug, glugging won't be driving you insane.
Got plumbing issues? Call Tim's Plumbing. They'll fix it fast, and more importantly, they'll fix it right. Tim's Plumbing specializes in installations, repiping, and service repair, and do new construction as well. Keep their number handy, 735-4969. And to learn more about Tim's Plumbing, like them on Facebook or visit timsplumbingmaine.com.
So when trouble pops up, you know who to summon. The master licensed technicians at Tim's Plumbing. Call them up and everything will be just fine. 735-4969. 735-4969.
In 1947, Jackie Robinson became the first to break baseball's color line, changed the face of the game, professional sports, and America. Ken Burns joined us to talk about that right before his special series on Jackie Robinson.
Ken, you've said that Jackie Robinson, in your opinion, is the most important person in the history of baseball. Is it crossing the color line, or is it the way he dealt with that that made him such a landmark figure?
Well, I think it's a combination. You can't sort of separate the action from the reaction and from the character from the person. He's not the best baseball player, but he is by far the most important baseball player that's ever lived, because he made the national pastime, in fact, what it had always claimed to be, the national pastime. It had systematically for many decades excluded African Americans from playing, and when he crossed the color line, broke the color line on April 15th, 1947, it was the beginning of the modern civil rights era. Martin Luther King was still a junior in Morehouse College. Harry Truman hadn't integrated the military. Brown versus Board of Education outlawing school segregation hadn't happened. There were no organized lunch counter sit-ins. Rosa Parks was a decade away from refusing to give up her seat on a bus in Montgomery, Alabama. So Jackie Robinson is a pioneer. Martin Luther King said he was a sit-inner before sit-ins and a freedom rider before freedom rides. And he is the only athlete in any sport in which his number is retired across all teams, and which no one is permitted to wear his number except on April 15th, when every player must wear his number on every single team. And that's an extraordinarily powerful, moving testament to what Jackie Robinson accomplished.
In telling the story of Jackie Robinson, how important was it for you to have the opportunity to speak with Rachel Robinson?
Oh, I don't think we could have made the film without her. She, in fact, had been the one that had been urging me to do a standalone treatment of Jackie. He had been a central figure, the central figure in our nine-episode, 18-and-a-half-hour 1994 series called Baseball. But she thought, quite correctly, he deserved standalone treatment, and she urged me over many, many years to do it, and finally we did. But, of course, she had to be, as far as I was concerned, as far as my co-producers and co-directors Sarah Burns and David McMahon were concerned, she had to be at the center of it. And she not only generously gave of her time and of the archives the Jackie Robinson Foundation, which she started, had, but she, you know, led us into her heart, gave us access to one of the most powerful love stories I know, not without complications, to one of the most amazing, you know, multi-generational stories of an African-American family, not without tragedy along with the triumph. And that's very generous. She's 93 years old. She's lived more of her life without Jackie than with him, and she didn't have to do this, but she wanted a complex thing. You know, Jackie's been so smothered in myth for the last several decades that he becomes kind of one-dimensional, and what we tried to do in this film is liberate him from that one-dimensionality and show him as a real person, complicated, flawed, but in fact, that in no way diminished the greatness of what he accomplished. In fact, I think it makes it even more inspiring, because nobody's perfect. None of us know a perfect person. And the more we transform our heroes into superficial kind of conventional wisdom heroes, we do them and ourselves a disservice.
Well, you mentioned the mythology, and as often the case in your films, you uncovered a lot of misunderstandings and outright fictions about Jackie Robinson. Was the Pee-wee Reese story the biggest fiction that you uncovered?
No, but I think it's the most obvious one, because this is a trope that we've been, you know, promoting. I mean, we did. We told this story in our 1994 baseball series, told to us by other people who should have known better, that, you know, the famous moment in his first season when they're traveling to Crosley Field in Cincinnati, home of the Cincinnati Reds. It's particularly virulent, and racist abuse is being showered down on him. And Pee Wee Reese is supposed to have walked over and put his arm around him in a show of solidarity. Well, it didn't happen. If it happened, it happened many years later and kind of migrated back to that first year. That first year, Jackie was playing first. He was always at shortstop, which meant he would have had to walk across the diamond, very unlikely. There's no mention of it in Jackie's autobiography, which paid particular attention to those white people who had been kind to him, who'd helped him along, who'd sort of, you know, gotten his back. There's no mention of it in the white press that day, and there's no mention of it in the black press, which would have run 20 related stories. And in fact, Rachel said, when they were building a statue to this non-existent event outside what is now Great American Ballpark in Cincinnati, she begged them not to do that and said, you know, use a different image, one in which you could verify it. There's no image of it. So I think it's one of those things where white people wanted to, you know, participate in this story to show that they were right thinking, to show that they were good. And it's a very wonderful myth in a way, but it's also not true.
We're talking with Ken Burns on Downtown. Jackie Robinson, the two-part, four-hour series begins April 11th on PBS. Ken, should people here in Maine be justifiably proud of the role of Clyde Sukeforth in the Jackie Robinson story?
Oh, you should. You know, I can remember as if it was yesterday an interview I did in West Waldoboro, Maine, in, I guess it was 1992. I took my then young daughter, Sarah Burns, who was not quite 10 years old, with me along on the trip as Clyde told the story of this being dispatched by Branch Rickey to Chicago to watch Jackie Robinson play and bringing Jackie Robinson back for the now famous meeting on Montague Street in Brooklyn Heights, downtown Brooklyn, with Branch Rickey, in which the deal was made that Jackie would turn the other cheek and that he would be brought first into their farm club. Now, I am very proud to say that this film is both directed and produced by David McMahon and that little girl, now grown up and a mother of her own, Sarah Burns, and myself. She and her husband, David McMahon, are the authors. I'm with them, the co-producer and the co-director, but they wrote this. So it's an amazing thing, and Clyde is what connects us. And there are very few instances in our film where we've gone back to earlier interviews to pull people up, Buck O'Neill and Red Barber being the other two, Clyde Sukeforth, who is in more than anyone else from that earlier film, and decided, because they've all passed, Buck O'Neill, the old Negro Leaguer, and Red Barber, the Dodger, famous Dodger broadcaster, and Clyde, that we wanted to, if you will, resurrect them for the purposes of this film. And Clyde we use more than anyone else, just because he was there in at the moment when the possibility that an African-American would join Major League Baseball, first the Montreal Royals and then the Brooklyn Dodgers, and change baseball forever. It's a great story, and everyone, not just in Maine, but everyone in the United States should be proud of the story and grateful for Clyde's honesty and memory and directness and modesty. That was the thing I remember most about him.
In your companion book to the baseball series, you talked about the role of Native Americans getting into Major League Baseball. Why is the story of Maine's Louis Sock Alexis not received the attention that certainly a Jackie Robinson has?
It's so funny that you said that. I don't feel that, because we gave him, you know, prominent attention in our baseball series and in our companion book. And it's so interesting that earlier today I had a conversation with someone who had been instrumental in trying to convince the Redskins to change their name, something I agreed with, but I didn't agree with changing the name of the Indians, because it used to be the Cleveland Spiders, but it was the death of Louis Sock Alexis that prompted them, out of grief, out of fandom's grief, to change their name to the Cleveland Indians. So it's honoring. Now maybe you could quibble and say what that Indian head looks like, reflects a more racist view, and maybe the mascot could be changed, or the logo could be changed a little bit. But it was interesting. I had a conversation about Louis Sock Alexis. I don't think I've ever had two conversations about Louis Sock Alexis in one day. So maybe he's not as forgotten as you worry.
We've talked before about race being the central issue in American history, and certainly, if nothing else, this election season demonstrates yet again that we're far from being in a post-racial America.
Yeah, no, we're not going to be in a post-racial America for an awfully long time. And I knew that even when Barack Obama was elected in 2008. You might remember the satirical magazine, The Onion, when he was inaugurated in January 2009. Its headline was not celebratory. It just said, "Black man given worst job in world." And that was just telling you that watch out, because people are going to, it's going to raise not only the pride of Americans who believe, as Lincoln did, in the better angels of our nature, but it's also going to bring out those, how shall we put it, unreconstructed brethren who somehow still don't think African Americans are equal to others. So, you know, I'm not sure if it's the sub-theme. I think the nature of freedom and the tensions between a collective freedom, what we all want, and an individual freedom, what I want, has always been a part of it, what the definition of freedom is. But the next one is race. We were founded on the creed that all men are created equal, but the guy who wrote that sentence, Thomas Jefferson, owned more than 100 human beings. Everything that came before the Civil War, 45 years after he wrote those words, were a product of that contradiction, that hypocrisy, and so much of what's followed has been a consequence of it. And a lot of people have criticized me for bringing it up, and I said, I don't go looking for it. It's just there. If you're interested, as I am, in understanding how my country works, you're going to bump into race. I think I've done, you know, 26, 27 films, and three of them that I can think of, Frank Lloyd Wright and the Horatio's Drive and the Dust Bowl, don't overtly deal with race. But that's not because I'm looking for it. It's just present. And I think we have to be honest with ourselves. And as much as we want to pretend that that's the case, I think, you know, what's nice is that people haven't criticized me for the last few years. But unfortunately, the reason why they haven't criticized me is that that picture has become clear. And it reminds us that human progress isn't always a straight line, that you take a couple steps forward and maybe a step backward. And I think we're in a retrograde moment where the bullies and the demagogues are able to shout fire in a crowded theater and arouse people out of fear, trying to convince them that, you know, the other is eating off their plate or taking away their job. And it's just not true. You know, I mean, we have an immigration situation and a big controversy, but nobody's explored it. Did you know that there is a net loss of Mexicans? That is to say, there are more Mexicans returning back to Mexico than are coming over here. And those that do come over here commit crimes at one-third the per capita times that sort of already arrived Americans do. So all of a sudden, if you're suddenly screaming about how bad those immigrants are, and you suddenly can take a breath and go, oh, wait a second, maybe it's not that bad. Or you say, the economy's in the shambles, everything's going to hell in a handbasket, and then find out, well, we've had 72 straight months of job growth, that we have a vibrant auto industry which was in repair, we have 20 million people who are insured that weren't insured again, and nobody with a pre-existing condition and can have their insurance denied, and that capitalism didn't fail, it actually survived. So maybe you can quibble with somebody over policy decisions or the way they acted on this event or that event. That's very American to do that. But if it's just wrong because of the color of the skin, then we still have a lot of work to do.
So, Ken, before we let you go, what lessons can we learn from the story of Jackie Robinson?
We can learn some of the most positive and heroic stories we know. He's one. This is not just a great baseball story, George Will told me back in 1994. This is not a great American story. This is a great human story. And this is a guy who, against all odds, did something, walked through a door, assumed and took on his shoulders the burdens of an entire race, withstood, you know, thousands of racial slights and abuse, and spent every day of his life, once he'd been charged with this great responsibility, spent every day of his life waking up, trying to make the lives of other people, not just black, but white, better. And he did it, and he said that a life is not worthwhile except in the difference it made in other people's lives. And, you know, a lot of us talk the talk, but he walked the walk, and it's an amazing honor to be able to get close to him and sort of strip him of that sentimentality and that nostalgia and find out that the real person or the truer person is much more interesting and much more heroic and much more inspiring than we could have ever imagined.
Ken Burns on Jackie Robinson here on our salute to Ken, who turned 65 this month. When we come back, Ken and his producing partner Lynn Novick on the Vietnam War. This is the Best of Downtown on Z62 Retro Radio.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
Spring's the time for everything new, fresh, innovative. Time for the brand new, all redesigned Ram 1500 at Hartley's.
The 2019 Ram 1500 is awesome. With more everything, more storage,
more performance,
more technology,
more efficiency,
and more leather.
In the new Ram 1500, there's safety all around you. It's the strongest Ram ever. Capable, built to serve, rugged,
and refined.
Start your own rebellion. Get yourself a Ram 1500 at Hartley's.
Don't miss the 2018 Jeep Wrangler, an all-new version of a true icon at Hartley's.
Diesel power, hybridization, and full-wheel, all-wheel drive are options. Wrangler is legendary for sport, fun, and work. The incredible 2018 is the most accommodating and comfortable Wrangler yet.
The new Ram 1500 and the all-new 2018 design Jeep Wrangler. Check them out at Hartley's.
The best deals on new Ram 1500s and 2019 Jeep Wranglers aren't in the city. They're in the country. Hartley's Country in Newport. Hartley'sCountry.com.
Thinking of making home improvements to increase efficiency? Well, there's no time like the present. And the people at Penobscot Home Performance want you to know that efficiency main rebates have increased from $700 to $1,000 per zone as of May 1st. Also, anyone with Bangor Gas can get rebates for $2,000 per insulation zone up to $5,000. Call to get your free home energy audit at 469-6100 or visit PenobscotHomePerformance.com.
Welcome to Green Acres Kennel Shop. How many?
Two dogs and a cat, please.
Remember us?
Rex, Sparky, and me, Fiona.
Of course, this way. Your coats are all looking so shiny. Bowl for three.
Ruff!
I'll take a side plate. Dog food's not really my taste.
Rex, try the Nutrisource. Delectable.
Yes, Master Sparky. Green Acres Kennel Shop only wants you to have wholesome, healthy food. So we prefer to work with small, family-owned companies who focus on pet foods.
Any specials this evening, Paul?
Of course, Master Rex. The usual lineup of dog and cat foods from Pure Vita, Natural Planet Health Extension, Signature.
How are they prepared?
Green Acres offers dry food, wet, freeze-dried, even frozen raw food to fulfill your fussy feline fancy. Now, because you all come to Green Acres Kennel Shop so often, your meals are deeply discounted as part of our frequent buyer program.
Wow, sounds like we're the special ones.
Green Acres Kennel Shop, where every pet is special. 1653 Union Street, Bangor, greenacreskennel.com, and on Facebook. Takeout also available.
We love Green Acres Kennel Shop, a home away from home.
We're back on Downtown and our salute to Ken Burns on Z62 Retro Radio.
I see a retro and I want it painted black.
Ken's most recent project to air on PBS found him teaming up with longtime collaborator Lynn Novick for a 10-part, 18-hour series on the Vietnam War. Both Ken and Lynn joined us to talk about Vietnam and its impact on America. The Vietnam War, if we look back at it, it's been nearly 42 years since that last chopper left Saigon behind. Ken, let's start with you. Why haven't we in America been able to put Vietnam behind us?
I think that's the number one question. It is unfinished business for us. A lot of it has to do with the defeat which stung. A lot of it had to do with the way, for a time, some of the veterans were received. Just the sort of difficulty of that war over, we believe, 30 years, beginning in 1945. We sort of think it's an early 60s thing. It's a little bit more complicated story that we try to tell. And it's time now, because so much of the divisions that we experience today sort of had their seed planted in Vietnam. And if we can unpack what really happened in Vietnam, and we've learned a lot of new scholarship, and we've talked to a lot of veterans, and we've also interviewed North Vietnamese and South Vietnamese folks to help triangulate this story. If we can unpack what really happened, we may be able to return to the more civil versions of ourselves.
Lynn, what would you add to that?
You know, I think it's a hugely traumatic experience. When soldiers go to war, we understand that that's a trauma. But I think the war was also traumatic at home because it became so unpopular as we began to question whether we could win it and whether we should be there. And for soldiers coming back into that debate, which became very, very heated, it was very painful. And we just haven't found a way to work our way through it. And part of it is, as Ken was saying, you know, we don't actually know what happened. If you live through it, you know what was going on around you and what you knew at the time. But it's a lot more complicated, and we felt one thing was very important for Americans was to fill in some missing pieces, which have been really obscure to us for the last 40-something years, which is, what was the war like for the Vietnamese, both the people who fought on the winning side and those on the losing side, the country that used to be called South Vietnam. And so we have worked very hard to hear from almost 100 people on all sides of the war, Americans who fought in it and who fought against it, and families who were torn apart by it, and families who lost somebody in the war, and Vietnamese on all sides. And it's just, it's a very complicated puzzle or mosaic. And we've found a lot of pieces and put them in an order that makes sense over 10 parts, 18 hours.
And I think it's remarkable, too, the work that goes into telling the story before American involvement. And people may be surprised to learn that Ho Chi Minh began the battle for independence by quoting Thomas Jefferson, and that he also reached out many times to President Harry Truman, but President Truman never got those letters.
Exactly, and this is one of the great tragedies. There's many, many instances when the primary sort of motivation for the Vietnamese resistance to the French and to the South Vietnamese government and to the Americans was essentially a desire for unification and independence. There were many opportunities along the way when we intersected in positive ways with Ho, or he was trying to reach out to us, beginning in 1919 with President Wilson, but most notably with Harry Truman, and we ended up in a Cold War proxy war siding with South Vietnam, and there's a lot of what ifs involved in that. But there, you know, no side is without blame. And what seems really clear is all three populations—the American population, the South Vietnamese population, and obviously the North Vietnamese population—were not served by their government. There was not complete candor by their government. Their governments didn't tell them what happened or weren't completely honest about it. And particularly in a closed communist society like North Vietnam, they got nothing. They only got good news. They didn't get the sort of messiness of democracy. But it led to a great deal of divisions and confusions, which we've tried to sort out in this film, and done so through the heroic testimony of folks who were Americans who were climbing up hills, and Americans who were, tending to the wounded, and Americans that were POWs, but also Americans that were back home suffering, as Lynn said, as Gold Star families, or as people beginning to say, hey, this war isn't right, and beginning to take to the streets, as is their democratic right, and protest. And so we try to put our arm around all these stories and don't make anybody wrong, create a space where all these various truths can coexist, and it'll help us, we hope, escape the kind of binary small p politics, the yelling and screaming that Lynn was talking about, and figure out how we might have a civil discourse today, not just about Vietnam, but who we are right now and why we seem to have made enemies of each other.
We're talking with Ken Burns and Lynn Novick here on Downtown, talking about their documentary, The Vietnam War, that debuts this September. For people of my age that grew up in the 60s and 70s who think of this as Lyndon Johnson's war and then Richard Nixon's war, the truth of it is, Lynn, that several presidents were a part of this process of getting us and keeping us involved there.
Yes, exactly. As Ken was saying, you really can go back to Truman and then Eisenhower and Kennedy, certainly. And, you know, for the bulk of our film, we do focus on Johnson and Nixon. But you have to understand that for all of our leaders, there's many, many different calculuses that they're making. Part of it is that, you know, at least at first, they wanted to contain communism, the spread of communism in Asia, and maintain our reputation as one of the most powerful countries on earth, and that we were, you know, what we said, we would stand by our word and stand by our allies. But also domestic political considerations, getting reelected in a democracy, exerted an enormously powerful force. And so that determined a lot of decisions that they made and choices that they made and things that they did and didn't tell the public. And as Ken was saying, the lack of candor about the war and the unwillingness to share with the public what they really knew, and what we've seen in listening to audio tapes of intimate conversations with Johnson and his advisors and with Nixon and his advisors. You hear them wrestling with sort of the impossibility of the situation that we found ourselves in Vietnam, and then going out in public or on television saying the exact opposite. And it happens again and again and again.
And if only, as we look back at history, if only people had listened to one of the heroes that emerges from this, or potential heroes, the Undersecretary of State, George Ball.
Yes, well, when Johnson was wrestling with the question of whether or not to send U.S. combat troops and to really escalate our involvement and try to salvage what was becoming a deteriorating situation in South Vietnam, really teetering on the brink of falling to North Vietnam, they had many conversations in the White House about this, and George Ball was given the job or, you know, took on the task of explaining why this was a bad idea, that we should not escalate, we should not send in ground troops. It was a recipe for disaster. We could never win. We would get bogged down, and the American public would tire of it. And he made his case, and then everybody else went the other way, and Johnson made the opposite decision.
Ken, your films always also manage to tell us history that we think we know through the lives of everyday Americans. What drew you to the incredible, powerful story of Mogi Crocker?
Well, it's just an extraordinary one. He's, you know, a kid that grows up in university towns and ends up spending most of his childhood in Saratoga Springs, and where his dad is teaching at Skidmore. And we follow his exploits over the course of two episodes, as told by his mother and his sister. And it's just a particularly ordinary, and then, of course, because there's no such thing as that, particularly in war, a very extraordinary story. And we invite you to get to know Mogi Crocker and his mother and his sister, and indeed other members of his family, and standing in for many, many other families in America who went through the kinds of hardships and agonies and decisions and doubts and reversals and letters and all of the things that personalized the war. It's hugely important that we not be distracted in this film by the boldface names. As Lynn suggested, we're going to get to know all those presidents from the top down. But we're not interviewing the familiar faces. We're interviewing the kid from the Ozark area, mountain area of Missouri. We're interviewing a Kansas kid and a Roxbury, Boston kid who go to the Marines and experience things. So what we try to do is make the people who populate our film, and that extends also to the Vietnamese, the South Vietnamese civilians and soldiers that we interviewed, the Viet Cong guerrillas who were fighting against us, the North Vietnamese soldiers that were fighting against us, the North Vietnamese civilians who were experiencing that regime and the lack of real candor and clarity from their government. They will be all authentic and familiar to all of us. They speak to us in direct, really human ways, and they communicate the most important part of the story, which is that in all wars, it's the individuals, it's the so-called ordinary people who do the fighting and the dying, and it's their stories we need to remember, it's their stories we need to honor, and it's their stories we need to carry back and try to divine the lessons from this story. And I think in many ways we've done that in this film, and we can't wait to share it with you all starting Sunday, September 17th, when PBS has an unprecedented rollout of it. If you work late, you can see it early. If you go to bed, you can see it late. If you get home, you can see it as a marathon. You can stream it. You can get the DVDs. I mean, they've really done a bang-up job.
Hi, Ken. This is Bruce Pratt. I had a quick question for you. I was in Vietnam a few years ago as a tourist. One of the things that I found in the North, particularly, no, I was only in the North, is how many Vietnamese looked at us, what are you mad at? Why were you mad at us? How did this all begin? Did you find that to be true of a lot of the people in the North?
I'll let Lynn answer that. She had some really extraordinary experiences.
Yeah, you know, we were never asked that question. And the thing that struck us, and I think strikes many Americans when they go to Vietnam, is that the lack of rancor and bitterness towards us, given that our country did cause enormous damage there, in the name of doing something to help the Vietnamese people. Millions of people died, not all because of us, but nonetheless, we were part of it. And we found the Vietnamese people incredibly warm and welcoming and open and interested in Americans and America and in our values and in our way of life and in our democracy and all of that. And so, and obviously in our popular culture, which, you know, that's true around the world. So it's a very young country. It's a very vibrant country. It's an extraordinarily resilient country. And, you know, I think many people who do know about the war, having lived through it, understand and feel quite strongly that it was the American government that made decisions, but the ordinary American people really, you know, don't bear responsibility for that particularly. And so, therefore, on a human level and on individual level, they really like to connect with Americans.
We're talking with Lynn Novick.
Welcome there.
Lynn Novick and Ken Burns here on Downtown. The episode that just took my breath away involved Joe Musgrave. And he told the story of the first person he killed in Vietnam. and then went on to explain how he rationalized things. And I this quote stays with me. He talked about racism being, as he said, a very necessary tool when you have children fighting your wars.
Well, just think about it. You've got an impressionistic teenager, you know, who feels invincible and immortal, as most of the late teenagers do. And they volunteer, as their fathers had done in World War II, and they were going to Vietnam. And they find themselves in an incredibly different kind of situation, in a very, very different kind of climate, with a different language and a different culture and different religions. And the only way you can sort of, as he says, stay sane doing what you're doing, and let's not sugarcoat what the duty of a soldier is to do, and that's kill the enemy, is to essentially reduce them, to turn them into something subhuman, to make them less than that. And the way you can, as he says, you know, when to have your children fighting your wars, you need to, he says, it's racism 101. You know, that's what you have to do, is dehumanize them.
Lynn, one of the veterans early in the documentary says, we were the last generation of kids who believed our government wouldn't lie to us. Will processing this 40 plus years later help us get closer to getting back to that point somehow?
You know, I'm not sure about that. I think, in a way, one of the things that came out of the Vietnam War that maybe was a good thing, and that'll be a question for our country to talk about and think about once the film comes out, but is that maybe we should have a little bit more, not skepticism per se, but we should just question, you know, our leaders. Do they know what they're doing? Are they up to the job? Are they competent? Are they principled, moral? Do they, you know, do they have the country's best interest at heart? And are they telling us the truth? And those questions really were not raised in a systemic way, in a sustained way, until the Vietnam War sort of unraveled toward the end of the war. It became very, very clear with the release of the Pentagon Papers, particularly, but leading up to that as well, there was a growing sense that maybe we're not really being told the full story, as Ken was saying. And so, you know, that's maybe healthy for a democracy, that, you know, our government should earn our respect and our loyalty and should not just expect it on sort of a knee-jerk basis. And so, you know, that we should just hold their feet to the fire and make sure that they do tell us the truth, and that we do understand why they're making the decisions that they're making, and that we're not being misled. So I think that's something we think that, yeah. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, and yet, Rich, you know, your question is really a central one, because, of course, what we've seen in the 40-plus years since the end of the Vietnam War is that skepticism, through the proliferation of all the websites and all the internet and the various politically oriented cable shows and other things and fake news, is that healthy skepticism that Lynn is talking about has also been replaced by a kind of conspiracy theory that's not based on any real stuff or stuff that is generally accepted by the mainstream. And then, in fact, the mainstream is, in fact, criticized for being just that. And what you end up is fraying the tapestry of our community and the things that bind us together as a community. And we begin to say that the people who don't agree with us are our enemy, rather than being the fundamental right of a democracy is to disagree and then to compromise in the course of working out those disagreements. And so, you know, one hopes that, you know, I don't think you ever get the genie back into the bottle that perhaps Vietnam released. But I think talking about it, as Lynn suggests, having the kind of courageous conversations I think we have to have after the show is broadcast about these questions, hopefully will bring us closer together and not the opposite, not send us in the knee-jerk fashion that we do now to whatever political corner we feel most comfortable in, and then fight from there. But to begin to see, as I was saying earlier, that there may be a possibility that more than one truth, and maybe even many truths, exist at the same time, and it would be possible to extend to the other a sense that the reality that they have, the eyes through which they see, the things that they believe, could be as equally valid as what I see and what I believe and what I perceive, to, in essence, not make the other wrong, as we do in almost every gesture in our political conversation today. And I think we can shed that.
Hi, Carrie Haskell here. Lynn, very early in the first episode of the series, there's a comment from a Marine veteran, Carl Marlantis, part of which is nobody talked about Vietnam. And I've found that true of the people that I've known that have served in Vietnam. What was the process like to get the veterans especially to open up about their experiences in Vietnam?
You know, I think he continues in that comment to say, but he thinks the baby boomers are starting to look back and ask what happened. And we found that to be absolutely true, that maybe enough time has passed. And so it's still, the memories are very fresh and in some cases very raw, but that the veterans we spoke with were eager to talk about the war. And that's not true of every single veteran. There were certainly some people we met who, you know, decided they didn't want to participate. But for the most part, I think it has to do with the passage of time and where, not where we are right now in this moment in our country, but, you know, we started working on the film 10 years ago. Most of the interviews were conducted around 2011, 2012. You know, we have, at that point, we're already involved in several other wars, asymmetrical wars that have been grinding on. And so they were feeling resonances with their own experiences and wondering, you know, have we learned the lessons of Vietnam? And maybe if I could share my story, maybe that would shed some light on where we are now and what happened then. And I think they were, you know, generally very eager. And I think we felt that over time, you know, Ken and I have sat down with many people and heard their stories, and there's something of, they're carrying a very heavy weight from not talking about it, and that there's maybe letting up a little bit of that burden by sharing it. And it sounds like a cliche, but it really is true. We just felt that over and over and over again, that they could let go a little bit of the sometimes very traumatic and painful stories, memories, experiences that they have lived with all this time. It was maybe, you know, a very productive and positive experience to share those stories with us.
So before we let you go, Ken, do we know at this point, all these decades out, what the lessons are and should be from Vietnam?
Well, I think the lessons are many and varied, and one of them we've certainly learned is that we're never going to blame the warriors again, as we did for a period of time before even the anti-war movement wised up and suddenly realized that this was the failure, if they believe that, of policymakers and not of the soldiers. So we've learned something. We tried in the first Desert Storm war to apply some of the lessons. There are many, many lessons. I think that Lynn and I would, rather than preach to you, as so many documentaries do, about what you should believe about something politically or what you should know, we'd rather share with you our experience of discovery, because so much of what people believe about Vietnam is either not true or outdated, and we can prove that in thousands of ways throughout the series, and then permit the rest of us to come to whatever lessons that they think we can take for them, because we're confident that with folks informed by real facts, and we've spent 10 years trying to verify these facts, that we feel safe in saying, you know, this is the way we believe it happened. And I'm sure we'll have people will point out some mistakes, and that's not an F4 Phantom, this is a this. But what we've tried earnestly to do is set the conditions for Americans of whatever political orientation they have, whatever age they are, whether they live through it or are, you know, completely unfamiliar with it because they're so young, would have an opportunity to be shaped by this and come to their own conclusions. And so besides saying hallelujah to the fundamental lesson that we are not going to blame the warriors anymore, then we'll leave it up to everybody else to sort of see. This is an immense tragedy, and also what happens in tragedy is that you find that two opposite things can coexist at the same time, and that's what you have to do in life, and we hope in an understanding of the Vietnam War.
Ken Burns and Lynn Novick on Vietnam as we wrap up our special salute to Ken. A happy birthday to him, and we look forward to talking with him again soon here on Downtown. Gary Haskell, I'm Rich Kimball. This is Z62 Retro Radio.